Welcome to Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. This program is produced to help women of color in leadership move from their zone of excellence to their zone of genius by eliminating any false upper limits caused by race, gender, culture, or their own inner critic. This program is dedicated to the legacy of Harriet Tubman, who held a lantern in the dark for all of us. I'm your host, ICF Certified Executive Leadership Coach, Joya Jefferson Nuri. Thanks for joining us again here on Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. I'm glad you're here. When I was a little kid, watching the Academy Awards on television was a thing. It was an event in our house. We got ready for it. We popped popcorn. We had Kool-Aid. I think my parents had whatever they drink. And we would sit and watch the Academy Awards. We cheered. We clapped. We had our favorite movie stars. My father was a big movie buff. My mother loved it also. And they instilled that on me. And as I got older, I made it a point to make sure I saw every nominated Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, and the supporting roles for women and men. And that came from a motivation from my dear friend who I met the first day of college, Russell Williams, and he's our guest today. So why did Russell inspire me to dig deeper into Hollywood, to see these films, and to see more kinds of films? It's because Russell Williams II always wanted to move to Hollywood and make a go of it. And he did. He was the first technician in Hollywood to win two Academy Awards. And he won them for sound. He won them for sound for the movies Glory and Dances with Wolves. And you can imagine doing the sound on those films was not easy. And the Academy awarded him two Oscars back to back. I mean, back to back, he got these Oscars. And so without further ado, I want to introduce you to my dear friend and very talented artisan, Russell Williams. Hi, Russell.
Hello, everyone. Hello, my dear Joya. Are you wearing gloves for the podcast today?
I'm even in jeans.
Okay.
So you have to tell the audience why you asked me that question.
Well, I was sitting on the steps, everyone, at the Student Center at American University in D.C. So this would have been my first day of sophomore year. And just kind of getting a look at, you know, the people walking across the quad. And, you know, this was in the early 70s. So there was some hippies, there was some Black power, there was some Pan-Africanism. But then there was this tall, brown skin, very, very just dignified looking woman walking towards me. And she was dressed very classy. I said, is she in the wrong spot, or is she teaching today, or I mean, what's going on? But she walked right over to me. I was sitting there on the steps, and she introduced herself, and I looked at her, and I didn't know where she had come to American from, but I assured her. I said, well, it's clear you're not from Southeast D.C., which is where I grew up. she had these gloves on, and she was very fashionable and just looked, you know, just too professional and businesslike to be coming to college for the first day. I thought maybe she was there for a job interview. And that was the beginning, as I said, in Casablanca of a beautiful friendship. And it has lasted unbroken and unbound since then. So thanks for the invite today.
You're welcome. I have to tell you that you looked me up and down and up down.
Yeah.
And I thought, what is happening? I'm just trying to make a friend on campus. And Russell's right. I had a handbag over my at my elbow. I had gloves, I had stockings, I had patent leather pumps. I had a suit on because that's how my mother dressed when she leaves the house. And I couldn't imagine going and wearing jeans all the time. It took me a while to realize I can tone this back.
Right.
And people who know me now know, people who know me now know I toned it back to who I am. But when we met, I was just so fascinated with your love of music. And I want to tell the audience, we are going to talk about the Academy Awards that will be coming up within days of the debut of this episode. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about Black Hollywood. But I first want you to know Russell Williams. When I first met you, I would come to your house and hang out, and you had a baby grand piano. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
you used to play the piano for me or take me to your music room where I sat in a chair that really did not have a seat cushion. So
correct.
I sat in the chair, but my butt was on the floor and you introduced me to jazz. So that for me was the beginning of why you're a sound man. But why don't you tell the audience how you made this evolution?
Well, Joy, like a lot of African-Americans that end up in entertainment or some aspect of the arts, it started in church. And my parents would drag me there by the earlobes every Sunday. And at first it was kicking and screaming. And then eventually I said, okay, well, you know, if I've got to do this, I'll make some friends. I learned so much, you know, in terms of just watching African-Americans who were maybe they were working sanitation, or maybe they were working in the State Department, or maybe they were doing something clerical, but at the church, you know, they were elders, they were Mrs. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so, and they were surrogate parents, aunts and uncles. They
yes, that's the community, the community.
You know, you couldn't get away. You go around the corner and thought no one saw you. Oh, somebody saw you, and they were at
yes,
you.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, you know,
we're telling our age with that story.
You know, okay. Yeah, and we're proud of our age because,
absolutely,
you know, things have slipped, I think, in a lot of ways beyond repair from a social standpoint and an awareness standpoint.
Agreed.
But the church sang a song that morning called I Hear a Voice of Praying, and the harmony and the way they blended and the tempo that they picked, you know, that morning. You know, I was kind of always listening to music, but that was the morning I decided I need to take music. I need to learn how to play an instrument or get introduced to this. You know, I want to know the discipline of music. So the nosy biddies in the other pews had told my mom that they thought Russell had been called to pray because they saw tears in my eyes. You know, the choir was rocking me so strong, you know, and they said, I think he's been called to pray. And I'm standing right there like I'm like, no, but I have been called to maybe find piano lessons somewhere. You know, I put the kibosh on that ministerial aspect.
Yes.
I said, no.
Yes.
But it actually started there. I had some great piano teachers. And as we, this year, one of the movies that doesn't seem to be getting Oscar love in terms of awards, but in terms of nominations, Maestro, about the great Leonard Bernstein.
I loved that film.
The thing about that film, which was relevant to this conversation, is one of my piano teachers actually went to Peabody Conservatory over in Baltimore. And one of the things that they sadly don't cover in the movie, but I believe it was one Saturday morning, Van Cliburn was supposed to have been Bernstein's guest on this television show called Young People's Concerts. And at the last minute...
And I want to say for the audience, the Young People Concerts was a staple in growing up. For us in our household. My father was an operatic baritone. And so introduction to music and Leonard Bernstein was in my house as much as Mickey Mouse.
Right. And it was, you know, so I think my piano instructors wanted to obviously immerse me in European concert music, which was not a problem. But I had neighbors who, when they had the record player outside in the backyard and there was a little barbecue or something, I was hearing Ramsey Lewis and Jimmy Smith and Jimmy McGriff and Dakota Staton and Nancy Wilson. And I was like, I'm kind of digging this sound too, you know? So that was an unofficial introduction to jazz. But what happened on that Saturday morning was this gentleman named Andre Watts, who's an African-American concert pianist student at Peabody, who Bernstein basically introduced to the world. And he's been, you know, playing concerts ever since. So, and on one side of me, I wanted to follow in those footsteps, you know, to be a concert pianist. But then once I started hearing people like Ramsey and Oscar Peterson, and later on Herbie Hancock and McCoy Tyner, and I'm like, I appreciate it. I still love The Chord Changes. One of my favorite movies about music is still Amadeus. But, you know, once I saw the Miles Davis Quintet rock and really saw how those individuals took what the masters had done and took it to a whole nother level, that was my introduction to really being a critical listener.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being at American, we had a radio program at WAMU-FM, which you can find on the internet, but you can't find our program anymore because it's pretty much all talk these days.
Yeah.
But that was my introduction to professional sound equipment. And then by the time, as we get to me, you know, making the nesty plunge to move to Los Angeles, all my work in sound really was informed by radio. So for me, anything I did on set, it had to work as radio, even without the benefit of the picture. But yeah, that's kind of like a short introduction of how I became,
but you know,
who's sitting across from you here.
Yeah, we have more stories to tell, but I want to tell you, I want to talk about the move from DC.
Okay.
It was you, Gary Featherstone, and it was supposed to be Jerry Brown, but Jerry Brown chickened out.
Right.
And you guys went out there, and it was almost like we were sending you off to discover the West, because we didn't know what the future was going on. And Aisha Mason had gone a year before.
Right. She was out there before, before me, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was almost like we're like, we may never see you again. We partied, we packed, we just got ready for you to go out there. But you know, Russell, I never doubted you would be successful.
Oh, I appreciate
I never, that. Ever doubted that you would be doing major feature films, winning awards and multiple awards, not just Oscars, and work with the big time. I just never doubted that. And so it's sort of like you were, I may have never told you this, I didn't want a life that fell short of yours. So so there was coattails, peer pressure, a lot. Like, well, Russell's in California doing this. What the hell am I doing?
You know, no, you were breaking down doors in network television. Don't let her be too modest, listeners.
Okay,
you know? Sitting around the house watching television and not earning a real wage and not blazing her own trails. But I appreciate the love. I appreciate the love.
Thank you. So you get to California, and from my memory, you were doing anything that would come before you for the experience, okay?
Right.
And some of it was, there was something you did with Art Garfunkel that was in D.C.
That came a few years after we got to L.A. Going to L.A. was, I would say this, it was one of those decisions where once you make it, and I'll say this early on in the podcast to anybody who's listening, and even I don't care how old you are, if you still have a dream or something you want to do, one thing I didn't understand or appreciate, I'll put it that way, in my early years was the value of the naysayers. Now, you may also call them haters, but I'm talking about really more naysayers, the people who have your best interest at heart, and they say, well, yeah, but you may need a little bit more practice of doing this, so you're not the best, you know, person in math, or you don't have the kind of skill set that I normally associate, you know. So those folks are trying to make a constructive contribution. Other folks, like some of the folks I work with at WMAL Radio at the time, they were like, oh man, you can't get a job out there. You know,
yeah.
I can't get a job out there. You can't get a job out there. So
which is why our friend stayed home.
Right. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, but the value of the naysayers are, if someone could simply whisper in your ear and talk you out of pursuing your dreams, you probably weren't going to get there anyway. Because
indeed,
as soon as you say yes, then you really have to deliver. The hard part, you think the hard part is actually getting that door to open. But now the door is open. It's okay. Well, what are you going to do? Now you have to deliver. Now you have to be on time. Now you have to know your craft. Now you have to work with the people, whoever they are. You have to find out how the politics of whatever field we're talking about works. And I'm going to tell you, because this is a button that we're going to put in the buttonhole a little bit later, but I got all of my personality, not so much from people I knew or family and friends, but dealing with total strangers, I got that perfected at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. Good morning. Welcome to McDonald's. How may I serve you? Would you like to try our new double cheeseburger?
Yeah.
Or do you want to settle for a double hamburger, right?
Yeah.
So you flip few decades. That's my name's Russell Williams. I'm your sound mixer this morning. Where's our first setup?
Yeah.
You know, so but what happened in DC, I'm dying to go to LA. I had to break up a love relationship in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard because to do what I wanted to do, and maybe some of you all listening want to do something that's not in the area you live in, it's probably easier to do this if you don't have any attachments. So you can get on a plane, be ready to go when they say go, and take light bags. You may not, you know, I have a 2000 album record collection as a result of my love of jazz and radio. I didn't bring those with me because you can't move light and fleet of foot with 2000 albums.
Right.
But the reason we got to LA is we ended up working with some filmmakers who came to DC. And so now we have addresses in our address book that have a 213 exchange.
Yes.
Area code, right? So,
And back then it was called a Rolodex.
A Rolodex. So my buddy, Featherstone, he went out immediately because he didn't have anything going on at the time. So he went right back with those LA people. I spent another year working, saving up money and, you know, trying to get
settled. But you were doing documentaries when you were staying here. You weren't sitting around on the sofa.
Right.
I was mastering the craft.
Right. And I was working nights at WML Radio and working during the daytime on independent projects. So I was burning the candle at both ends, literally. But it all led to 21 July 1979. And if any of you all saw the Eddie Murphy movie Dolomite, the very first gig that I had in L.A. was working for Rudy Ray Moore at the Dunbar Hotel, which he was living in the basement. And I ended up working with Eddie three more times later on in my career. And he was the only person I ever worked with who really wanted to hear Rudy Ray Moore stories.
Yeah.
I mean, he sat down like Rudy, you work with Rudy?
This is Eddie Murphy.
You know,
yeah, right. Yeah.
But I wish I had worked on that movie because the production design wasn't as tacky as Rudy Ray.
As Rudy
real
was.
I mean, I said, no, y'all got, y'all, I said, you cleaned him up. No, no, wait a minute. You go to his, back then you went to his little restroom and he had a AM FM radio toilet paper dispenser.
What does that mean?
Meaning that your toilet paper dispenser was also an AM FM radio.
I can't picture that.
Well, like I said, if Eddie and them had hired me on that, I would have.
You would have been able to tell them that. Right.
He had wallpaper that had Greek cherubs, you know, like you would see with the grapes, and so one above and one below. But someone had meticulously taken the time to put hair on these cherubs. I mean, take hair from wigs and glue them. You know what I'm saying? I can't make this up.
I'm telling you.
So Joy, the long story short, I'm sitting there doing this. I came all the way across country. I'm doing this and I kept kicking the floor. And then the boom guy that my buddy Gary had introduced me to, a guy named David Brownlow, who's since become an Oscar nominated sound mixer, he said, "Man, what are you doing?" I said, "Man, I'm just making sure that this is the bottom. There's no level below this, so you know, we can only go up from here."
Yeah.
And literally, we did. And it took years.
Mm-hmm. It took years.
And I want to say the first real sound stage I got to see was over at what's now Sony, but back then was still MGM.
Yeah.
And so that show was a little nighttime soap opera called Dallas. And standing on that stage,
I remember you on that show.
I looked at all these people, from grips and electricians to the costumers to the director, the camera people. And so, ladies and gentlemen listening, I said at that moment, I must commit 10 years to making this LA thing work before I can throw in the towel. Yeah. I had no illusions that I was going to knock on the door, smile like, hey, you know what I'm saying? I'm here. I could do that. And they're like, yeah, kid, line begins way back in Poughkeepsie. You know, because coming to LA in 79 to make it in the industry was not an original idea.
Yeah.
I'd come out there 50 years before, it would not have been an original idea. So
even then,
just understand, when you want to be in a highly competitive field, there are going to be a few people already in line ahead of you.
You know, this harkens back to the work I do as an executive leadership coach. And this show is generally focused on Black women in leadership. But I knew you would be the guest that would talk about that tenacity. And what you actually did, and we didn't have this kind of language back then, 1978, 79, you know, even back to 71 when we met, the inner critic gets in the way of most people making that leap. Mm-hmm. The voice that says you're not going to make it. It's not just the external voices that are going to say that. You know, they're just going to amen what your inner critic tells you. And that when you can hear that voice and still move past it, that's victory. When you can say, I want to do this so much, I'm going to commit 10 years minimum to make this happen. Most people 10 months in, they're gone. You know, if they go that long, because this is hard. And it didn't happen the way it happens in the movies where Judy Garland and, you know, Mickey Rooney have a play in the barn on Saturday. Right. It takes a long time to do this and to stay committed to it. And to find something you love that much is hard to do for most people. But even when they find it, they would have been to hug the tree as opposed to going out on the limb.
Yeah, the limb is where the fruit is. So if you want to eat, you're going to have to go out on the limb, and that limb gets kind of shaky. And I think a lot of times people do have a unrealistic expectation. And I sometimes compare this journey to folks who've had great careers in sports. You know, you start out throwing the ball or hitting a tennis ball or, you know, chasing your friends around, and that becomes a track and field career. But it takes you years before you finally get to the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
so if you look at how many years somebody has put into doing something like that, don't expect that it's going to take you less time, even though we have all these gadgets in front of us. But I think the person who really brought the journey into focus for me was a woman who I'm sure you'll appreciate and who was with us one of those momentous nights leading up to Oscar number
two. Before you say that, I know what story you're going to tell.
Okay.
But when Russell does these years, these yeoman years, and there was one story where he called me, and it was 4:30 in the morning in Los Angeles, and it's 7:30 in the morning here. My phone rings, and it's Russell, and I'm like, "Hey, what's up?" And he says, "Look, I just fell backwards out of my truck, and I hit my head on the concrete." So I'm going to go in the house.
Now people think I'm crazy now, right?
Yeah, right. He's fell backwards out of the truck with all the equipment.
I literally fell out of the truck.
Hit his head on the concrete. And he calls me and says, "Oh, I knew you'd be up at 7:30 East Coast time. Call me in a few hours to see if I'm awake." And I'm like, I said, "Sure, Russell." I'm like, "What the hell?" And so I called Featherstone. I said, "Get up. I know it's 4:30 in the morning. Russell has hit his head on the concrete," you know, and it's like, "Oh my God." So that was a story. And that's the story of our connection and the friendship and the support we give each other. But that was crazy, Russell. I think you should go on to a hospital, but you're still here. But
well, I did call them, and they said, "Look in the mirror, make sure my pupils were the same size." They said, "Don't go to sleep, you know, if you can avoid it." And
okay, who didn't tell me any of that when you were calling me?
No, but I called them after we had spoken.
Oh, after we spoke. Okay.
Yeah, after we spoke.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I said go to a hospital.
Right.
But
right.
You did call them. That's good to know.
Because I didn't want to get in the van and then conk out and then make matters even worse. So I'll stay put.
Okay, you call them. Yeah. All right. Good story to tell me 35 years later. But
well, you know. You have to have some surprises on
you
a good
have to have
podcast.
Surprises. Right? But Russell started to, in this Oscar circle, they had this program, a celebration of Black Oscar nominees. And right. Russell kindly invited me to come out. Every year he's nominated for me to hang out with him and the movie stars. And so he's going to an event, which will be tomorrow. The show is being recorded on February 20th.
Okay.
But he's going to another event tomorrow around the same thing. But let's go back to the Black Oscar nominee parties that we went to back then. And you were telling me about the illustrious queen who helped you.
Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as a dungaree wearing, dashiki wearing, back then had hair, so I had something.
And wait a minute, I forgot to tell them, in college we called you Damu.
Right, right. Well, we were trying to keep it out of the government's file, but
you were Damu.
I was Damu at WAMU, right? WAMU. And somehow or the other, we called the publicist of this author, a lady named Maya Angelou.
Yes, indeed.
And she was in town doing a book tour for Gather Together in My Name, which would have been her second book after Caged Bird. And she was gracious enough to allow this college jock in a public radio station, who knows how many or few listeners there were, didn't matter to her. She says, well, yes, you know, so they set it up. I went and met her at the Madison Hotel. Brought my cassette player, a couple of microphones. We sat down for an hour and just kind of got to know each other. But within that interview, as she's talking about leaving Mississippi, having this dream of going to Paris to go to this club that was run by this woman named Bricktop, who was famous all over Europe, and to become a dancer and learn how to sing. And while she was in Europe later, she got the bug to figure out how all these movies are put together. So she went somewhere, I don't know if it was Finland, Sweden, I think it was Sweden, to learn how to direct films. And, you know, it was just amazing, the absolute audacity to leave Mississippi and know almost no one and forget Los Angeles, go to another country and plant some roots. And in that interview, she mentioned how at the time, which again is mid-70s, how kind of disappointed she was that young people of my generation weren't taking those kind of calculated risk to further their dreams and to pursue their dreams. Okay. So not only did I play that on the air, but just about any time that I had to do something where I knew I was going to, there was an old commercial back in our era. You could probably find it on YouTube about Nest Tea. And the slogan was take the Nest Tea plunge. So anytime I was about to take that plunge, I'd put Miss Angelou's, you know, interview on and listen to it in my headset or on my Walkman or what have you. And so the closer I got to catching that plane to LA, the more I was listening to her. Okay.
Yeah.
Now I don't see her again in person until I believe it's probably March 24, 1991. So this would be the evening before Oscar number two.
The potential of Oscar number two.
Yeah.
At that point.
And everyone has said, okay, Russell, you're going to win a second Oscar. And I said, there's absolutely no way I'm going to get another Oscar and not back-to-back. Forget about it. I was honored to get a back-to-back nomination. But in that particular event, Joy is there covering it for, I think, America's Black Forum. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Were you working for
ABF? I don't know who I was working for then.
Yeah, I think it was ABF.
ABF, okay.
And so I look out there and there's Miss Angelou in the audience, and whatever I had in terms of prepared remarks, I just threw them to the side because I said, don't mean to call you out, Miss Angelo, but I do mean to call you out because I haven't seen you since, and I had a rough date. And she looked at me when I said, yeah, and we did this interview about, you know, Gather Together My Name, and her eyes got really big, and she put her hands on her face. And I said, to see you here tonight is probably the strongest omen I would ever get, because I played your words in my head over and over again. Okay, so stop being a coward. Get on the plane. How bad could it be? I said, the worst fear I had, I'm going out on a TWA jet that I may have to ride back on a Greyhound bus. But to me, a failure, a potential failure, is better than a regret.
Yes,
because
indeed.
Because that regret indeed will haunt you the rest of your life. I should have. You know, and the fact that I came out, if I had dropped out one day before I got a phone call, maybe Joy's interviewing somebody else, but I stuck it out. And also, the whatever you put into the universe, you keep sending that signal, it's going to come back to you.
It's going to come back to you. Now, as an aside to his glorious story about Madame Angelou, I don't know if, I think it wasn't that particular party, but there was another party that weekend or some L.A. trip just to hang out with you. I am there. Steve Ferrier is there.
Right.
A couple people, and we're getting our picture taken. I hand my camera to somebody to get our picture taken, and Denzel jumps into the picture. I have to send you this picture. He jumps into the picture.
That would have been the year before.
That would have been the year before.
That was the
glory year.
Exactly.
That would have been the year for glory.
Yep.
So now Russell has worked on Glory. Then we'll get to Dances with Wolves. But Russell has worked on Glory. And the funny thing that you said, that every film that Denzel has won an Oscar for, you did the sound.
Correct.
That's two.
That's so Glory you count, and Training Day.
Yep. Back in the day, you were saying Glory and Training Day. And the back in the day, you used to say, I have four Oscars because I count Denzel's.
That's right. Right.
No.
And he's like he's the most nominated black actor in history now.
Yeah, that's what I read.
But let's see. He's still... is sitting comfortably on two Oscars.
On two Oscars. Okay. All righty then. And then the following year, right after you finished Glory, you went off with Kevin Costner to do Dances with Wolves.
Right.
Tell us about that experience.
Well, I think if we look at my career arc, And I mentioned way back in the day, McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
That I think young people today may have this impression that once they get to the big arena, then they're going to put their best foot forward, right? But if society is anywhere near the same sort of composition that it is now, you need to start putting your best foot forward right now.
This moment.
So while you're making minimum wage, that does not mean you put forth minimum effort.
Indeed.
Okay. So the button on that story, working at McDonald's, Glory, so that would have been February 14th of 1990. The nominations come out. I don't have any idea how to find out whether I was nominated. It's not like today where you have the internet.
It's on the Today Show or Good Morning America.
But they wouldn't have had the sound award on it.
Oh, they would not have. Yes, right.
See, they wouldn't have gone that deep into the nominations. Now,
right.
All I had to do was call the Academy and ask them, but I didn't know that. So who do I call, Joya? I called Joya Newery.
Who worked in the newsroom?
She was there at CBS, and there's this thing you all
and
young people.
And I was Joya Jefferson then. I was Joya Jefferson.
Joya Jefferson. You Google this thing. It's called a teletype machine.
That's right.
Google it, because I know I'm talking about ancient technology. That was our text and
I went to the Associated Press.
because I knew, I could have waited until the next day to see it in the newspaper, but who could wait that long?
Right.
So Joya goes, you know, back in D.C., we're all a continent apart. She goes back and looks at the teletype, and there it is, sound, and she calls me and leaves me a message on my answering machine. And where am I working that day, Joya, when I pick up that message?
I don't remember.
I was working a McDonald's commercial.
Oh, that's right.
So you're talking about
irony.
A button.
I remember
you're talking
that.
About a button.
Right, that's right.
Okay.
Right. You went from working in McDonald's to working to promote McDonald's.
Right.
Okay.
With a black PR company from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
On the day
I get my first, and they stopped the commercial when I got some cake and champagne. We did a little party there because most of these fast food places have a store that's actually a studio.
Yeah.
But the reason that I got the call to work on the movie in the first place, to go back to my put your best foot forward early, is because the unit manager that called me to come to meet the producer director I had worked with on the show that never even made the airwaves. I was amazed that it's even on IMDb. It was called Just an Overnight Guest. Mm-hmm. It starred Rosalind Cash and Richard Roundtree. It never went anywhere, but that unit manager remembered me. And this is like maybe 5 years later, the next time he calls me, he says, I think you should come and meet our producer and director. We're doing a Civil War movie starring Matthew Broderick, and I think it's a project you should be considered for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so long story short, that became Glory. Okay, there's another movie that's essential to my leaving D.C. and then my career really jump-starting after 9 years. It was a movie called Field of Dreams.
Oh, my God, why would I forget that?
The only reason...
Was that before or after Glory?
That was before.
That was before. Okay. Field of Dreams.
Because, and luckily it was
before. That's when I came out and I met Phil Robbins.
Right. And because it could have been, if they had been on the same year, then I could potentially have been competing against
yourself.
Myself, you know, so I'm glad that Field came first and Glory came after. So, but the whole point of the Field of Dreams story is another thing that you don't hear about much in the business, but I assure you, loyalty is a major part of it. Relationships is a major part of it, because I don't get Field of Dreams unless the director, Phil Alden Robinson, who had written the screenplay, went to the producers, the Gordon brothers, Chuck and Larry, who you probably don't know, but you know their franchise. It's called Die Hard.
Yeah.
So they begged Phil to direct the movie. He didn't want to do it. They offered him more money. He didn't want to do it. They said, what will it take? He says, hire my entire crew from my first movie. That way I'll be standing in front of family, people I'm already comfortable with, and then the only unknown quantities will be the actors. And that's how I get to Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams gets me to dances, because that's the first time I meet and work with Kevin Costner. And he did something similar. He brought people from his other movies, from No Way Out or from Bull Durham. You know, he brought a few of us from Field out to South Dakota to do dances. So trust and believe, as they say, if you think these relationships that you're in high school, college, the job you have now, people are watching you. People are watching your work ethic, your people skills, your attention to detail. All of that could culminate, not necessarily with them hiring you, but they say, you know, that Joya, she's a hard worker. And someone says, you know, I've noticed that too. You know, the referral is sacred in this field, and anything else
in
is highly competitive.
Else. Right. You know, it's so interesting. I'm so glad you're saying all of this, that it's every moment of your life has to be an excellence. And when I do public speaking coaching, I say you have to talk to the barista at Starbucks the exact same way you talk to the board president. You have to have the diction. You have to have gravitas. When you do it, you have to have your posture straight. When I work with my clients, the same thing. And excellence has to happen all the time. My manicurist always commends me on what I'm wearing to get my nails done.
Right.
I live in a downtown area, so I'm very walkable. So I walk to my manicurist, I walk to my grocery store, I walk to what I need to do. I never know where my next client's going to be. I never know who I can help, who will be work until. So every time I leave the house, I have to look like you will trust me. I have thought this through that I'm not going to go over there in fuzzy slippers and yoga pants, because between here and there, or even there, I don't know where the next woman will be who will need my services. So I'm so glad you're saying all of this.
And I'm so glad you're saying that, because that's what drives me crazy, especially when I was still living on the East Coast. And, you know, on the West Coast, I'll put it this way, in Los Angeles, for sure, you really are, I mean, yeah, now they have a little bit more, you know, light rail and things like that. But for the most part, if you're dependent upon public transportation out there, they look down on you. On the East Coast, it's the way you get around if you have an IQ above room temperature, because for the most part, you can't find any place to park even when you do get
right.
there. And if you do, it's going to cost you more than rent or your mortgage if you do find a parking, a paid spot, right? But what I'm getting to is the people that are on the train, some of them, this might be the only moment of their day when they're going to be able to read, kind of get their thoughts together, have a little peace and quiet. And whatever that job is, if it's a job they hate, if it's a job they love, you know, they can just kind of settle themselves on that train ride. And folks who have a habit of not caring about how loud they are, what comes out of their mouth, what sort of behavioral skills they didn't learn at home, or if they did, they figured it's the time for us to act like we're in the middle of the playground. It's like all of that is telling someone, okay, well, this is what you potentially get if you hire somebody from this group.
Right.
So, and worse than when we were coming up, everything you do is on camera now.
Yes.
Everything. You are on camera wherever you go, whatever you do.
Right.
So
right.
if you do get caught on camera, you might want to look like, A, you have an IQ above room temperature. were using your grandmother's manners. If she didn't have any, go back another generation.
Right. Go back another generation.
Okay.
You know, I have a story. I have a friend who runs a very successful business in Washington, and she walked into Starbucks, and there was this woman in Starbucks absolutely acting a fool.
Okay.
Loud, angry at the barista, foul language, just acting out because something about her coffee was not right.
Right.
I mean, it was like she was three having a fit, and other people were saying, you know, give it a moment. She's snapping at other people in the Starbucks.
Right.
So my friend eventually gets her coffee and goes back to her office, but she was interviewing for executive assistance that day. This woman who was acting a fool in Starbucks is like her second interview that day. And the woman sat down. Clearly she's going to recognize her because it just happened like 40 minutes ago. And she said to the woman, my friend said to the woman, "Were you just in Starbucks?" And the woman lost the color in her face. She says, "Well, I was there, and nothing about you says that I want you to be my executive assistant, my representative. So there's no reason for an interview. I need you to get out. But I hope the next time you will recognize that every moment somebody's watching you." And that was in a time when there weren't cameras everywhere. But somebody's always going to watch you. So you need to be excellent all of the time.
There's a military term, and I wasn't in the military, but I worked on a lot of military films and in certain cases, even training films. But they're weapons that are laser guided.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is a device that points a laser beam that's invisible to the naked eye, say to a house.
Yeah.
And then the airplane that's dropping the ordnance, that ordnance sees that laser beam, says, okay, that's the target, and it goes and hits, does its job. So in the military, they have a term, paint the target. Okay. If paint you're already a target, you don't need to paint yourself. You don't need to be, you don't want to be on that radar.
I mean, I don't understand it.
Okay, if we can all agree that we are twice as likely to be treated violently if in just a routine traffic stop.
Now, right, right.
In certain cases, you know what I'm saying? I'm not going to go into detail, but in certain cases, it's kind of like you should try to give yourself a half a chance. You know, just like, good morning, officer. How are you? Here's my ID.
Right. You know, as opposed to coming out belligerent.
Yeah, because I think for me, it's mainly because the TV lawyers never emphasize the fact that you do not have the right to drive in the first place.
Right.
It's a privilege.
It's a privilege.
So you might want to, you know, hold on to those privileges. You know, your rights may not have been violated because you got pulled over, but if you say, we're going to paint the target.
we're going to do donuts
in the middle of the intersection. Or whatever.
Right,
you know, No. You don't want to be on that radar.
Don't paint yourself. You're already a target.
You know, look.
Yes.
You know, my dear.
I want to get back to the movies for a second here.
The movies.
I still love the movies. And so I want to tell the audience that Russell has now moved on to producing. He teaches. He was artist in residence at our alma mater, the American University, and taught a new generation of filmmakers, which is incredible, and taught them script writing and production and a whole new generation. And it's really nice that you went back to our alma mater. You went back to the American University in Washington. So like another pinpoint. You started here, now you're coming back in a whole nother role. It's really nice to know.
I took that cue from another DC homie.
Who's that?
A guy named Robert Hooks. So Robert Hooks left D.C., created the NEC, co-created the NEC in New York.
The Negro Ensemble.
And then he went out to Hollywood. He was in big movies like Trouble Man, television.
And he had an illustrious career.
And then he came back to D.C. for a while and created D.C. Black Rep.
I was part of D.C. Black Rep.
See, so now I'm thinking, okay, so I needed to come back home to D.C. My mom had passed away years before that, but my dad was still around. I got 11 more years with him, but I wanted to come back to the school that had given me so much and given us so much in our respective journeys, because, I think if undergrad doesn't do anything else, right, you should take it for the research skills that you learn.
And
the fact that these kids now can just go to something called Google and these other sites.
Oh, what a cheat. They don't know anything about the Dewey Decimal System or how to look it up without that thing. Because, you know, I told my daughter, your goddaughter,
right.
my daughter is Russell's goddaughter. He's godfather to my daughter. And I told India, if I had Google when I was in high school, I'd be an astronaut. I would cure things, and I'd be Miss America. All in the same week. I had to do was go to some device and look it up and have 5,000 resources.
Yeah, I mean,
and
you don't have to go out into the weather. You don't have to go out into the weather. You know, you don't have to say, oh, my goodness.
You don't have to go apply for
a library card. You don't have to understand the card catalog. Okay.
No, you don't.
And trust me, I feel that education, be it four-year, technical, you know, graduate, all of those institutes do have a purpose. They do have an agenda, but say that's not what you're into. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you're not into that. But ladies and gentlemen, let me assure you, you must love knowledge.
That's it.
Okay. Whether you are sitting in a formal classroom or whether you're sitting there at the knee of a wise woman or a wise man, or you are using a device to go down to an art gallery and say, okay, well, why does that look like that? And how is that music created? And how is that light? Why is that light pole?
It's not only knowledge, but it's curiosity. Just curiosity about everything. But we're going back to the movies.
The movies. Okay.
The movies. All right. So we're recording on February 20th. For anybody who's listening to this, it's going to debut on March 5th so people can get a perspective as to where we are. So we're recording after the Oscar nominations come out, but before the Academy Awards, which are March 10th, 2024. So, if you have a list of the films in front of you and what you're predicting for this?
Yeah, I mean, when we look at the events that lead up to the Oscars, as we're recording this, the British Academy has just spoken,
BAFTA.
Or the BAFTAs. Mm-hmm. And so, for the most part, I think Oppenheimer has the momentum in most of the major categories.
Yeah.
So Best Picture, I'm fairly sure nothing's going to move Oppenheimer off the Best Picture mantle this year.
Not even
Oscars.
Killers of the Flower Moon.
And of course the BAFTAs don't necessarily have the U.S. American sensibility. So not saying whether the film has the strength or not. I just don't know if the British audience really relates to the story that Killers of the Flower Moon beautifully portrays.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But just looking at what's happened in, the DGA, which kind of speaks for...
And for those who don't know it, it's the Directors Guild of America.
So those individuals... Not all of the DGA members are members of the Academy directing branch, but I assure you everybody in the Academy directing branch is in the DGA. So that kind of signals what they think.
And you get, and explain to people how you become a member of the Academy.
Oh my God. You talking, okay, you all get a pencil and paper or a pad or something. So each branch of the Academy has their own set of rules. So in my branch, which is sound, I think it takes you 8 years of experience. Whereas if you come in as an actor, the first time you get nominated for something, that might be enough on one nomination to get you invited. And if you've been in the business for years and you haven't been nominated, just about any branch, two people who are members already can write a letter on your behalf and say, we think Gioia Nuri should be a member, and the committee will make a decision. And since, Oscar So White hit, then a lot more of the members have been diverse since that was made plain that, we as the viewers, the audience, the society are just kind of tired of this kind of being mostly about
white people
and not about America writ large.
Yeah.
Okay. So for Best Actor, it's, I think most of them.
So I want to go back to Best Picture for a moment.
Oh, Best Picture. Okay.
I think that Maestro would do better had it been nominated on a different year.
You can't be one. It's always, there's always like, it's like this heart-wrenching decision that you have to make as a voting member, which of course I'm going to have to, I think the actual voting starts 2 days after we're recording this.
So February 22nd.
So I'm like, and the Best Picture isn't as much of a heartstring puller for me as Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
Because Sterling Brown was awesome in American Fiction, but also Robert Downey Jr. was just amazing.
As in, you never thought about Iron Man.
No.
Robert Downey Jr. has always been an incredible actor. Remember when he did Chaplin?
Oh, that's when I knew he was an incredible actor, because who could do all that physical stuff that Chaplin did? Okay.
And since we see so much of Charlie Chaplin, I believed he was Charlie Chaplin. It wasn't like some obscure figure.
Right.
He had to be Charlie Chaplin. But I want to go back to this Sterling Brown and Robert Downey debate. I'm going to bring up something you said a long time ago. It's like, you know what I'm going to say. Russell would say, white men can't jump, but nobody says they can't act. It's always been. So the debate, if I had to vote, and thank God I don't, is that Sterling Brown was amazing.
Amazing.
But as he always is, consistently wrote television, movies, Black Panther, he's always amazing. But when you looked at the performance of Robert Downey Jr. and how that character had such an arc.
Right.
That's from here, where we thought he was fabulous. I hope everybody's seen the film. Where he thought he was fabulous to, damn, is that who he is? He has such an arc. So you would have I would have the loyalty, like, this is a brother. Sterling K. Brown.
Right.
But then if you really just look at the art, it's like,
I tell you, it's gut-wrenching, because the other thing that many of our actors and actresses have said is they could put up a hell of a performance, but the thing that is still largely unequal, forget about the actual pay rates, but largely unequal is the quality of the material. In other words, I would say comparing Oppenheimer to a movie that came out a few years ago that put these Black actresses in a very powerful position was Hidden Figures. Mm-hmm. Because you're talking about, for a general audience, who knew that the lives of these astronauts are really in the hands of these math experts who had a permanent tan.
Yeah.
Okay. So now when you look at American Fiction, it's a very personal kind of character-driven story about a family and the dynamics between the two brothers and the mother and the sister, and then a love interest, right? And then, I mean, there have been several films and television shows that have dealt with the whole issue of the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project.
Yes.
You know, but it just so happens that the way Christopher Nolan looks at it as a character study.
In Oppenheimer.
And, you know, but my lovely wife, Rosalind, didn't even recognize Robert Downey Jr. when she first saw him. You know, and I was sitting there waiting until she said, "Is that Ross?" I said, "That's RDJ right there."
Yeah.
So you have that. And of course, you go back to Killers of the Flower Moon, Poor Things, Past Lives, Maestro, which sentimentally, you know, being someone who, like, as we were talking about earlier, who grew up watching Bernstein, you know, on television, and I never got to see him in person, you know, in front of the New York Phil. But, you know, that's one that I would also have a connection with because of how he got an African-American concert pianist on the scene.
So
it showed that if you have talent, I can open doors for you.
We don't care about
your complexion. That's not a problem I have. Okay.
No, for the audience who hasn't seen Maestro, it is really worth the journey to see the emotional pieces with his wife. And so if you know his music, you see the dimensions of this man. And I'm not going to go into all the dimensions. You'll find out when you see the film. But it is really one of those sit back with a glass of wine and just let it happen around you. I just felt it was so beautiful. But I know it was not going to stand up against Oppenheimer, even though it got nominated.
Oppenheimer and
Killers of the Flower Moon. So you had shifted over to supporting actor. We talked about Sterling K. Brown versus Robert Downey Jr. I think we would both vote for Robert Downey Jr. So let's go to Best Actor, which is like, woo, look at this. So if we want to do Black, we have Colman Domingo.
Right. And
Jeffrey Wright. Okay, two different films, two different characters. So Coleman, for those of who don't know, Coleman Domingo was in Rustin. And he's the first gay actor to play a gay character to get nominated for an Oscar. And from friends of mine that said his Rustin was right on.
And see, of course, I only know Bayard Rustin from the footage of him when he was at this meeting or that meeting.
But he was very flamboyant.
He knocked it out of the park.
He knocked it out of the park. Jeffrey Wright was being Jeffrey Wright. Okay. So in this Best Actor, you know, Paul Giamatti for the holdovers.
Right.
How can you argue with an actor who could play John Adams? I mean, he's always.
And see, here we go. See, I worked with Paul Giamatti.
You did?
When he was chained to a file cabinet, being berated by Samuel L. Jackson.
What film was that?
In The Negotiator. He's sitting there on the floor in J.T. Walsh's office.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So I'm like, and I mean, the man has got talent. That I mean, you look at him and you're like, yeah. But he's Bart Simpson, right?
Yeah. I just came across that film on Netflix and almost stopped to watch it again, but didn't, you know, knowing I was going to see you today.
Yeah. And then, I mean, we even tried, and Roz and I aren't big wine drinkers, but we even tried to develop a taste for wine after Sideways.
You know what? Sideways. That film Sideways, it actually made me drink Merlot. Because they were talking about, oh, no, never Merlot. I'm like, what the hell is this Merlot? And they're right. Oh, no, never Merlot.
Yeah, I know we're talking about this year's Oscars, but for both of us, the power of cinema has also been a key aspect of our lives, because for me, the 1959 Ben-Hur is still the movie that I still find things that I was introduced to by Ben-Hur in that film that have manifested in my life, even going to the gym and being on the rowing machine. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I said, now, why am I enjoying this? You know, because when the commandant walked between the slaves and the slave ship and Charlton Heston was holding his oar, he said, listen to me, all of you. You are all condemned men. He says, we keep you alive to serve this ship, so row well and live. And I assure you, that rowing machine has helped keep me alive. I would have never said no, because of course they were rowing because they were being whipped.
Right. You know, I'm rowing to stay alive
because I want to whip myself into shape. So back to this year.
Best actor, who would you vote for?
Oh, God. Well, see, as an Academy member, I can't.
Cillian Murphy.
Yeah, Killian.
Cillian Murphy, who was the star of Oppenheimer. Okay, so, and Bradley Cooper was great.
And also directed the movie.
Yes, he did. Bradley Cooper was great in Maestro. He really was. The cadence of his voice, he did a lot of good work on that one. So who would you vote for? So we have the nominees of Paul Giamatti, Bradley Cooper, Coleman Domingo, Cillian Murphy, and Jeffrey Wright.
Well, what I can say is this. As a member of the Academy, I can't.
Oh, you're not supposed to tell me. You can't tell me. I knew that. You can't tell me ahead of time who you voted for.
I can't tell you.
You can't tell me. So who I would vote for in that would be Cillian Murphy.
Okay.
Okay. And the only thing I thought about Cillian Murphy doing it.
Right.
I wish. Oh, no. Please come his name. Two Left Foot. What is the actor's name? He played Lincoln.
Yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis.
I wanted for the first half of the movie, I kept saying, this is Daniel Day-Lewis's role.
Right,
this is Daniel Day-Lewis. But
he retired. Yeah. So see you by nothing personal.
Yeah. So Cillian did good.
Another thing for your listeners about the Academy. So the way it's structured, the people in each branch nominate. Mm-hmm. So if I'm an actor, I can nominate actors best supporting, Yeah. If I'm in cinematography, I can only nominate cinematographers. If I'm in costuming and on down the line. The only other nomination we all get as members is for Best Picture.
For Best Picture, okay.
Now, once the nominees have been established, now we can all vote for whoever got nominated in whatever
category. In any category, right.
But, you know, as much as I wanted to nominate somebody who's an actor, I have to wait for the acting branch to put their name in. And there was a movie earlier in the year named Chevalier.
Yeah.
About a black violinist.
Yeah.
That was.
I remember this.
And it's like it didn't even happen. It's funny. Yeah. I mean, this guy was actually playing the violin. That wasn't AI. So you have that issue of things that are released in the early part of the year, like now. You know, we're talking in February, so it's not until the big summer movies and after that people start generally remembering the big performances.
Right. So those things that are released in the year become more Oscar.
And it may not necessarily be better, but generally speaking, that's when the heavy-duty dramas are more front of mind. Yep.
Right. So since you can't tell me who you would vote for.
That's right.
The nominees are for Best Actress are Emma Stone, Lily Gladstone, Annette Bening, Carey Mulligan, and Sandra Huller. Well, I would tell you, I am personally very tired of Emma Stone living in the 1600s. Her British accent sucks. Okay. I mean, she's just living in the 1600s, and the one she won for was the same year that they mixed up that film.
Yeah, LA, La La Land. Yeah, La La Land. With Moonlight. Right.
With Moonlight. I think they mixed up that too because there's no way you are against Natalie Portman and say, who's doing Jackie Kennedy and Ruth.
Nager? Is it Nager?
Yes. Yeah. Ruth Nager. There's no way Emma Stone won that. Okay, so this is just my opinion. I'm not in the business. Russell didn't say it. I didn't say it, except that I have been in the movie theaters with Russell and embarrassed him in Hollywood, but with my opinions. So this is my podcast. So my vote is going to go to Lily Gladstone.
Okay. Who I couldn't take my eyes off of. I would say out of that group, out of that, it would be, to me, it would be between Lily and Annette Bening.
I would say Annette Bening. I love Naiad. For those of you who have never seen it, Naiad, excellent filmmaking, excellent performance for her and Jodie Foster.
Right.
But I think I want Annette Bening because I want to see women of that age back on the screen and in leading roles. Okay.
And she held her. I mean, she had, and Jodie Foster was excellent in that.
Well,
as well.
She's definitely the best actress vote for me, Jodie Foster. But so, Lily Gladstone, because my sentimental, she's the first Native American nominated for Best Actress. She's like the Hattie McDaniels.
Right.
From Gone with the Wind, black woman nominated for Best Supporting Actress at that time. There's something about Lily Gladstone and needing to see more of these stories about, you know, we think what happened to Native Americans happens with cowboys and the cavalry, but the torture of their existence continued on and continues on. So there's something about Lily Gladstone, but if Lily Gladstone was not there, Annette Bening would walk away with this remade, and clearly not Emma Stone. So
the only other, and then Carey Mulligan, who is excellent.
Always good.
But she didn't really grab me until in the film she starts having challenges. And I mean, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
Once again,
in the storyline.
Once again, an arc.
And that's the, all of a sudden, then I'm like, okay. So I said, that's where she got her nomination. To me, the first part of it was nice. You know, it was kind of like, you know, hey, I like you. Hey, you like me. But then when it got really serious, and I was like, oh, okay. But I was like, okay. So I, Anatomy of a Fall. Not really.
But you know, I have to tell you, Carey Mulligan would have been brilliant if Annette Bening wasn't running this year.
Annette
Bening doing Naiad, and like, because Carey Mulligan did her job.
Right.
Annette Bening is Annette Bening. And I'm sorry that for the last 25, 30 years, we haven't seen that much of her. But I know she's raising a family and she did what she had to do. So I want to go next, before we get to the supporting actor. Oh, we did that already. We did supporting actor. We didn't do actress. Uh-huh. But I would say that the best animated feature, because now I've added that to the list of things I want to see before the movie started. But, you know, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse has won before.
Right.
It's a great series. I mean, I'm a Spider-Man. I'm a Marvel Comics freak. So I see all of that. But I would tell you, Elemental.
Okay. I have to
Elemental. You have to see it. Let me tell you about Elemental. Elemental is these people who are on fire. And how all the elements are interacting with each other.
Okay.
And so what makes Elemental win for me, other than the boy and the heron, which is beautiful.
Okay.
But Elemental captivates my 3-year-old grandson.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
And it's a complicated story. It's a complicated story. And we went away to Disney for a week. And every night when we came back, when it was time to go to bed, he wanted to see Elemental. So, of course, in the course of a week, I have now seen this movie. And now I'm like, wow, this is really good. I said, you understand this? He said, yes. And I'm sure he doesn't understand it the way I understood it.
Right, right.
But I got captivated by it to a point where it didn't annoy me by day five.
Okay. Well, that's good because, you know, I think it is a particular type of genius that has to go into anything that's animated, because those filmmakers know if it's aimed at kids, then more than likely the adults have to bring them to the theater.
Yeah.
So there's certain parts of that have to keep the adults interested. And I remember when my kids were small, we would, you know, see stuff like Aladdin, and Robin Williams was so brilliant in the background, imitating people like Jack Nicholson.
Oh, no, I see. The animation would have the character, like Jack Nicholson would see Jack Nicholson's drawing, a drawing of him.
But the kids didn't know who Jack Nicholson was.
No.
The kids didn't know who Walter Matthau is, you know. But you would hear that in the impersonations he was doing, and that's for the benefit of the grown-ups who were there. And then later on, the kids may say, okay, if they ever go back and watch old movies.
Yeah,
you know,
again.
But so it's a particular type of genius that had, because if you want the whole family to appreciate it, there's got to be, you know, different acorns in there that, you know, that everybody can pick up on.
You're not going to be bored. Like, please don't play that movie again.
Right. My kids, I knew my kids were going to be okay when they came out of Pikachu or whatever that was. And they apologized to me because the movie was so horrible. And they said, Daddy, we're sorry we made you come
see this. What made you watch that?
If they realized that
it was bad, then it must have been pretty bad.
You know, I said, okay, you guys are going to be all right. I think I like you all. I think I'll keep you all.
I used to make my parents sit through the movie twice. Whatever movie they took me to, I mean, I'm like elementary school. And we went to see a movie. We had to see it twice.
And you could do it for free.
Yeah,
right?
You could do it. Nobody moved you out of the theater back in the day. Right. But we would have to see it twice. And I don't remember my parents ever trying to say, no, we saw it. Let's go home now.
Right.
It was
like,
would you like some more popcorn? And we would watch it twice. And I now look back on that and I'm like, that was parenting. Because right now, I don't think I could sit through most kids' movies twice.
Right.
You know? I mean, like, no. So anyway, best actress as our last category. Oh, best director. So we have Justin Trett from Anatomy of a Fall, Martin Scorsese, Killers of the Flower Moon. I'm going to slaughter this man's name, Yorgos Lanthimos.
That's pretty good for what you know. I'm just doing it phonetically as well.
Oh, yes,
I think it's probably Yorgos, but
Yorgos. Okay, but it's Y-O, but that's all right. I hope he's listening, but not listening. Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer and Jonathan Glazer for The Zone of Interest. I have to say, I have not seen The Zone of Interest.
Okay. It's definitely worth seeing.
So I can't really do that.
Definitely worth seeing.
Okay. Well, also, the audience, so what Russell gets as a privilege of being a member of the Academy is that all the movies we stand in line to go see, and after, you know, they sent him DVDs of every possible movie. And so he can sit at home and do that.
They used to.
They don't anymore?
You have a secure link.
Oh, you can go in and see them all.
They're not even pressing DVDs anymore. So my collection of DVDs has come to an end, you know, because that was always the fun about having the hard copies. You go back and play these movies. So I think after the award season is over, those links kind of, you know, become inactive. And then as the newer movies start queuing up, then you can see stuff. Okay. I try to see the big things on the big screen because it's a whole different experience.
It's a whole nother experience.
That's the way the director wants you to see it.
Yeah, exactly. So since you're not voting, I am going to vote for me, it would be Christopher Nolan or Scorsese. But I think Scorsese tackled a far more complicated story that is new and so I think they both, so if, you know, there was a tie 1 year, remember, with Best Actors is Barbara Streisand and Katharine Hepburn?
Right.
So I could go for a tie on this one. I could definitely go for a tie on this one, but if I had to vote, I think I'd give it to Scorsese.
Okay.
But I wouldn't give him Best Picture. That's interesting. Right.
Yeah. The only thing that makes it mathematically unlikely is that he didn't win the DGA award, the Director's Guild Award.
Christopher Nolan
But again, for the Oscars, the entire membership gets to vote, so it won't be just directors. So they may see it differently.
Well, you know what? I'm going to change my vote. I'm going to go with Christopher Nolan because it drives me mad when a Best Picture and that director do not win.
Right.
Like, how does that work?
It's like
since I voted for Oppenheimer,
the picture directed itself. In other words,
the picture directed itself. Right. The sound man directed the movie. Yeah. Right. And then the last piece, I've already said Jodie Foster. And you know, so interesting, I would not see the film Color Purple.
Okay.
I would not go see it because I didn't see Alice Walker's name anywhere. It wasn't Alice Walker's Color Purple.
I think it's on the end credits. I don't know if it's on the front credits.
No, I'm talking about the billboards, the posters, the interviews.
Oh, no.
It was Oprah's Color Purple.
Yeah.
And for me, an Alice Walker fan, I'm just in the middle of reading the book that Valerie Boyd edited her journals.
Okay.
To discredit Alice Walker and make this about Oprah and make this about Steven Spielberg and not cast any of the old cast members who could have, whatever, I don't know, maybe 40 years is too much for you to come back and
well,
do
one
it.
Well, one person made a cameo, but yeah, that was it.
So I couldn't go. I actually went to the theater because friends of mine were doing a panel discussion.
Okay.
But I left when the theater got dark. In solidarity with Alice Walker.
Okay.
And so now the audience knows I'm loyal. Totally loyal.
Right. Well,
you know?
I mean, there was really only Danielle Brooks got nominated.
Only up.
You know, Roz and I saw it at home. We did not go to the theaters to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that there was some negative energy surrounding that set. Now, I wasn't on the set, but you can kind of see it in that the performances could have been a lot more upbeat, even if you're talking about a scene where, you know, we're talking about tragedy and emotional stress, you know. But I just didn't think that Color Purple was going to get anything. And I think that of the people in that great cast that put their work in, Danielle Brooks was likely the only.
Who did she play?
Oh, what character did she play?
I mean, you don't have to tell me. I'm not going to see the film, but I just wondered. But if we're going to vote here, Emily Blunt.
She played Sophia. She played Sophia.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And you know, if you haven't read the book, please read Color Purple. Don't go see the Steven Spielberg movie. It's a good movie. It's a great movie, but read the book. So I would say that Emily Blunt was magnificent in Oppenheimer, but I kind of thought that was Emily Blunt. Her performances for me are starting to be Emily Blunt. She was great. That character was probably more complicated than most of the characters I've seen her play. I'm happy with that. I'm happy to see her grow. And I love watching her on the screen. I mean, I'm from Devil Wears Prada all the way through. Yeah. I thought I was going to hate Mary Poppins because who could do it better than Julie Andrews?
But right. She was very solid in that. Yeah.
She was solid as Mary Poppins. And then she gets this role and it's like, whoa, she got chops. Right. Okay. But who has chops for me? Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
In Naiad. I mean, first off, for Jodie Foster to play that role with no makeup, no hair, no nothing. Both of these women, Annette Bening, they are just elder women trying to achieve something nobody on the planet has ever achieved. And as an elder woman trying to achieve something that nobody's ever achieved, I had an affinity to them. I can relate. I can totally relate and not be written off because of your age. I mean, there's nothing in me that's not still 35 except my right knee.
Right.
My right knee clearly knows how old she is.
That's my left knee.
The podcast that will air right before you is called Old Chicks No Shit. So I interview a podcast host that's the name of her podcast.
Okay.
And we talk about what happens at 60.
Okay.
When people start to say to you all the time, when are you going to retire? When are you going to retire? Like, stop asking me that question. I'm going to retire 2 minutes after they cremate me.
Right.
Okay, that's it. So Russell Williams, my dear trusted friend and superstar, it is so nice to have you on my podcast.
It's been a blast. And I think this is actually my first podcast.
Really? Yeah, I'm so honored.
Yeah, I mean, you know, before
you do interviews all the time. Right, you do media interviews all the time.
In the podcast space, this is number one. Uh-huh.
Wow. I'm more excited than I was before.
It's appropriate.
And you know, for the audience, it's not like Russell and I don't talk all the time. It's not like these conversations are all new, but it was really nice to have it confined and focused.
Right.
As this podcast has been able to do. And I really am going to promote it. There's so many. I was taking notes, all the lessons that can be learned, all the information that I want to make sure I put in the promotions. So thank you very much for joining us here on Unshackled Leadership, A Lantern for Black Women. And you are also the second man I have had on this podcast in the year we've been on the air.
Okay.
One was my coach, Ken Kaiser, 30 years, and now you. So people I have known forever, men I've known forever, who were instrumental in shaping my life and shaping my ability to know love. And that's one, you're it, Russell.
Okay. Mutual.
All righty then. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for the invitation, and I hope that your listeners remember you have to dream it and then you have to do it.
Oh, what a nice place to end. Thank you. I want to thank you for joining us for another episode of Unshackled Leadership, A Lantern for Black Women. I want to thank the people who make this all possible, beginning with our senior producer, India Tisdale of It Takes Pure Effort Consulting, and our program editor, is Grammy Award nominated singer and obviously extraordinary editor, Carolyn Malachi. Dominika Eldridge of Unique Creatives created our phenomenal artwork. And Hotham of HothamMusic.com created the theme song that you listen to every single show. Again, thank you for joining us, and I hope that you will be here for our next episode. Peace and blessings.